seems to cry out to us, doesn't it? But what of World Park? Clark shrugged. Maybe Carlos knows something they need. Maybe he has a stash somewhere that they want, or information, or contact numbers, maybe even cash. There's no telling, is there? And I think it unlikely that he can be persuaded to cooperate with us. Clark grunted. Damn Skippy. What I can do is talk with the chaps at 5-2. Perhaps this Russian shadow fellow worked with the PIRA. Let me do some nosing around, John. Okay, Bill, and I'll talk things over with Langley. Clark stood, wandered out of the room, and headed back to his own, still groping for the idea he needed before he could do something useful. It didn't start well, and Popoff nearly laughed about it. On reaching his rental car, he opened the left side door instead of the right side. But he figured it out in as few seconds as it took him to load his luggage into the trunk, boot, and get in the driver's side. From that point, he opened the map book he'd purchased in the terminal and made his way away from Heathrow's Terminal 4 onto the motorway that would lead him to Hereford. So, how does this thing work, Tim? Noonan moved his hand away, but the pointer stayed right on Chavez. Damn, this is slick. It's supposed to track the electromagnetic field generated by the human heart. It's a unique, low-frequency signal. Doesn't even get confused by gorillas and animals. The gadget looked like a ray gun pistol from a 30s science fiction movie, with a slim antenna wire out the front and a pistol grip underneath. It swung on a frictionless bearing, drawn to the signal it received. Noonan moved away from Chavez and Covington and headed for the wall. There was a secretary sitting right there. The gadget locked on her. As he walked, it stayed pointed at her, through the blank wall. "It's like a bloody divining rod," Peter observed, no small amount of wonder in his voice. "Like finding water." "Does look that way, doesn't it? Damn, no wonder the Army wants this baby. Forget about being ambushed. This thing's supposed to find people underground, behind trees, in the rain. Whenever they're there, this thing'll pick them up." Chavez thought about that. He thought especially about his operation in Colombia so many years before, walking point in the weeds, looking and listening for people who might have worried his 10-man team. Now this thing replaced all the skills he'd learned in the Seventh Light. As a defensive tool, it could put the ninjas out of business. As an offensive tool, it could tell you where the bad guys were long before you could see or hear them, and allow you to get close enough to... What's it for? What's the manufacturer say, I mean? Search and rescue. Firemen in a burning building, avalanche victims, lots of things, Ding. As a counter-intruder tool, this puppy's going to be hard to beat. They've been playing with it at Fort Bragg for a couple of weeks. The Delta guys have fallen in love with it. Still a little hard to use, and it can't tell range yet, but all they have to do is modify the antenna for greater gain, then link two of the detectors with GPS and triangulate. The ultimate range this thing can achieve hasn't been determined yet. They say this one can lock onto a person at 500 meters. Bloody hell, Covington observed. But the instrument still looked like some sort of an expensive small boy's toy. "What good will it be for us? It can't tell a hostage from a terrorist," Chavez pointed out. "Ding, you never know, do you? Damn sure it can tell you where the bad guys are not," Noonan pointed out. He'd been playing with this thing all day, getting a feel for how to use it effectively. He hadn't felt like a kid with a new toy in quite a while. But this gadget was so new and so unexpected that it should have arrived under a decorated pine tree. The Brown Stallion was the name of the pub right next door to his motel. It was only half a kilometer from the main gate at Hereford, and seemed like a good place to start, and, better yet, to have a beer. Popoff ordered a pint of Guinness and sipped at it, surveying the room. A television was on, carrying a soccer match. Live or taped, he couldn't tell at the moment, between Manchester United and Rangers from up in Scotland, and that attracted the attention of the pub's patrons, and the barman, as it turned out. Popoff watched as well, sipping at his pint and listening to the chit-chat around the room. He was trained to be patient, and knew from experience that patience was usually rewarded in the business of intelligence, all the more so in this culture, where people came to their regular pub every night to chat with their friends, and Popoff had unusually good hearing. The football game ended in a 1-1 tie around the time Popoff ordered a second pint.
"Tie, bloody tie,"
one man observed at the bar seat next to Popoff's.
"That's sport for you, Tommy. At least the chaps down the road never tie and never bloody lose. How are the Yanks fitting in, Frank?"
"Good bunch, that lot. Very polite. I had to fix the sink for one of the houses today. The wife is very nice indeed. Tried to give me a tip. Amazing people, the Americans. Think they have to give you money for everything."
The plumber finished off his pint of lager and called for another.
"You work on the base?" Popoff asked.
"Yes, have for 12 years, plumbing and such."
"Good lot of men, the SAS. I like how they sort the IRA buggers out," the Russian offered, in his best British blue-collar accent.
"That they do," the plumber agreed.
"So some Americans are based there now, eh?"
"Yes, about 10 of them, and their families."
He laughed.
"One of the wives nearly killed me in her car last week, driving on the wrong side of the bloody road. You do have to be careful around them, especially in your car."
"I may know one of them, chap name of Clark, I think," Popoff offered as a somewhat dangerous ploy.
"Oh, he's the boss. Wife's a nurse in the local hospital. Haven't met him, but they say he's a very serious chappie. Must be to command that lot. Scariest people I've ever met, not the sort you'd like to find in a dark alley. Very polite, of course, but you only have to look at them to know. Always out running and such, keeping fit, practicing with their weapons, looking dangerous as bloody lions."
"Were they involved in the showdown in Spain last week?"
"Well, they don't tell us any of that, see, but..."
The man smiled.
"I saw a Hercules fly out of the airstrip the very day it happened. And they were back in their club late that night, Andy told me. Looking very chuffed with themselves, he said. Good lads dealing with those bastards."
"Oh, yes. What sort of swine would kill a sick child? Bastards,"
Popoff went on.
"Yes, indeed. Wish I could have seen them. Carpenter I work with, George Wilton, sees them practice their shooting from time to time. George says they're like something from a film, magical stuff, he says.
Were you a soldier?"
"Long time ago, Queen's Regiment. Made corporal. That's how I got this job."
He sipped at his beer while the TV screen changed over to cricket, a game for which Popoff had no understanding at all.
"You?"
Popoff shook his head.
"No, never. Thought about it, but decided not to."
"Not a bad life, really, for a few years anyway," the plumber said, reaching for the bar peanuts.
Popoff drained his glass and paid the bill. It had been a pretty good night for him, and he didn't want to press his luck. So the wife of John Clark was a nurse at the local hospital, eh? He'd have to check that out.
"Yeah, Patsy, I did," Ding told his wife, reading the morning paper a few hours late. Press coverage on the World Park job was still on page 1, though below the fold this time. Fortunately, nobody in the media had a clue yet about Rainbow, he saw. The reporters had bought the story about the well-trained special action group of the Spanish Civil Guard.
"Ding, I... well, you know, I..."
"Yeah, baby, I know. You're a doc, and your job is saving lives.
So's mine, remember?
They had 30-some kids in there, and they murdered one."
"I didn't tell you.
I was less than 100 feet away when they did it.
I saw that little girl die, Pats.
Worst damn thing I ever saw, and I couldn't do a damn thing about it," he said darkly. He'd have dreams about that for a few more weeks, Chavez knew.
Oh?
She turned her head.
Why?
'Cause we didn't... I mean, we couldn't. Because there was still a bunch of others inside with guns on them. And we just got there, and we weren't ready to hit the bastards yet. And they wanted to show us how serious and dedicated they were. And that's how people like that show their resolve, I suppose. They kill a hostage so we'll know how tough they are.
Ding set his paper down, thinking about it. He'd been brought up with a particular code of honor even before the United States Army had taught him the coat of arms. You never, ever hurt an innocent person. To do so forever placed you beyond the pale, irredeemably cursed among men as a murderer, unworthy to wear a uniform or accept a salute. But these terrorists seemed to revel in it. What the hell was wrong with them? He'd read all of Paul Bellow's books, but somehow the message had not gotten through. Bright as he was, his mind could not make that intellectual leap. Well, maybe all you really needed to know about these people was how to put steel on target. That always worked, didn't it?
What's with them?
Hell, baby, I don't know. Dr. Bellow says they believe in their ideas so much that they can step away from their humanity, but I just don't get it. I can't see myself doing that. Okay, sure, I've dropped the hammer on people, but never for kicks, and never for abstract ideas. There has to be a good reason for it, something that my society says is important, or because somebody broke the law that we're all supposed to follow. It's not nice, and it's not fun, but it is important, and that's why we do it. Your father's the same way.
You really like Daddy, Patsy Chavez, M.D., observed.
He's a good man. He's done a lot for me, and we've had some interesting times in the field. He's smart. Smarter than the people at CIA ever knew.
Well, maybe Mary Pat knew. She really gets it, though she's something of a cowgirl.
Who?
Mary who?
Mary Patricia Foley. She's D.O., head of the field spooks at the agency. Great gal. In her mid-40s now. Really knows her stuff. Good boss, looks out for us worker bees.
Are you still in the CIA, Ding? Patsy Clark Chavez asked.
Technically, yes.
Her husband nodded.
Not sure how the administrative chain works, but as long as the checks keep coming, he smiled, I'm not going to worry about it. So, how's life at the hospital?
Well, Mom's doing fine. She's charge nurse for her shift in the ER now, and I'm rotating to ER 2 next week.
Deliver enough babies? Ding asked.
Just one more this year, Domingo, Patsy replied, patting her belly. Have to start the classes soon, assuming you're going to be there.
Honey, I will be there, he assured her. You ain't having my kid without my help.
Daddy was never there. I don't think it was allowed back then. Prepared childbirth wasn't fashionable yet.
Who wants to read magazines at a time like that?
Chavez shook his head.
Well, I guess times change, eh?
Baby, I will be there.
Unless some terrorist jerk gets us called out of town. And then he better watch his ass, 'cause this boy is going to be seriously pissed if that happens.
I know I can depend on you.
She sat down next to him, and as usual he took her hand and kissed it.
Boy or girl?
Didn't get the sonogram, remember?
If it's a boy...
He'll be a spook, like his father and grandfather, Ding observed with a twinkle. We'll start him on languages real early.
What if he wants to be something else?
He won't, Domingo Chavez assured her.
He'll see what fine men his antecedents are, and want to emulate them. It's a Latino thing, babe.
He kissed her with a smile. Following in the honorable footsteps of your father.
He couldn't say that he hadn't done so himself. His father had died at too early an age for his son to be properly imprinted.
Just as well. Domingo's father, Esteban Chavez, had driven a delivery truck. Too dull, Domingo thought.
What about the Irish? I thought it was their thing, too.
Pretty much, Chavez grinned. That's why there are so many Patties in the FBI.
Remember Bill Henriksen? Augustus Werner asked Dan Murray.
I used to work for you on HRT. Bit of a nut, wasn't he?
Well, he was heavily into the environmental stuff, hugging trees and all that crap. But he knew the job at Quantico. He laid a good one on me for Rainbow.
Oh?
The FBI director looked up and instantly focused at the use of the code word. In Spain, they were using an Air Force chopper. The media hasn't caught on to it, but it's there on the videotapes if anyone cares to notice. Bill said it wasn't real bright. He's got a point.
Maybe, the FBI director allowed. But as a practical matter...
I know, Dan, there are the practical considerations, but it is a real problem.
Yeah, well, Clark's thinking about maybe going a little public on Rainbow. One of his people brought it up, he tells me. If you want to deter terrorism, you might want to let the word get out. There's a new sheriff in town, he said. Anyway, he hasn't made any decision for an official recommendation to the agency, but evidently he's kicking the idea around.
Interesting, Gus Werner said. I can see the point, especially after three successful operations. Hey, if I were one of those idiots, I'd think twice before having the wrath of God descend on me. But they don't think like normal people, do they?
Not exactly, but deterrence is deterrence. And John has me thinking about it now.
We could leak the data at several levels, let the word out that there's a secret multinational counter-terror team now operating.
Murray paused.
Not take them black to white, but maybe black to gray.
What will the agency say? Werner asked.
Probably no, with an exclamation point behind it, the director admitted. But like I said, John has me thinking about it a little.
I can see his point, Dan. If the world knows about it, maybe people will think twice. But then people will start to ask questions, and reporters show up, and pretty soon you have people's faces on the front page of USA Today, along with articles about how they screwed up on a job, written by somebody who can't even put a clip in a gun the right way.
They can put a D-notice on stories in England, Murray reminded him. At least they won't make the local papers.
Fine. So then they come out in the Washington Post, and nobody reads that, right?
Werner snorted.
And he well knew the problems that the FBI's HRT had gotten into with Waco and Ruby Ridge after his tenure as commander of the unit. The media had screwed up the reporting of events in both cases. As usual, he thought, but that was the media for you.
How many people are into Rainbow?
About 100. Pretty big number for a black outfit. I mean, their security hasn't been broken yet that we know of, but...
But as Bill Henriksen said, anybody who knows the difference between a Huey and a Blackhawk knows that there was something odd about the World Park job.
Hard to keep secrets, isn't it?
Sure as hell, Gus. Anyway, give the idea some thought, will you?
Will do.
Anything else?
Yeah. Also from Clark. Does anybody think three terrorist incidents since Rainbow set up is a big number? Might somebody be activating cells of bad guys and turning them loose? If so, who? And if so, what for?
Christ, Dan, we get our European intelligence from them, remember? Who's the guy they have working the spook side?
Bill Tawney's his chief analyst.
Six guy. Pretty good, as a matter of fact. I know him from when I was the legal attaché in London a few years ago.
He doesn't know either.
They're wondering if some old KGB guy or something like that might be traveling around, telling the sleeping vampires to wake up and suck some blood.
Werner considered that for about half a second or so before speaking.
If so, he hasn't been a raving success. The operations have some of the earmarks of professionalism, but not enough of it to matter.
Hell, Dan, you know the drill. If the bad guys are in the same place for more than an hour, we descend on them and take them out the instant they screw up.
Professional terrorists or not, they are not well-trained people. They don't have anything like our resources, and they surrender the initiative to us sooner or later. All we need to know is where they are, remember?
After that, the Thunderbolt is in our hands.
Yeah, and you have zapped a few, Gus. And that's why we need better intelligence, to zap them before they show up on the radar scope of their own accord.
Well, one thing I can't do is their intel for them. They're closer to the sources than we are, Werner said. And I bet they don't send us everything they have anyway.
They can't. Too much of it to fax back and forth.
Okay, yes. Three hard incidents looks like a lot. But we can't tell if it's just coincidence or part of a plan unless we have people to ask. Like a live terrorist. Clark's boys haven't taken anyone alive yet, have they?
Nope, Murray agreed. That's not part of their mission statement.
So tell them that if they want hard intel, they have to have somebody with a live brain and a mouth after the shooting stops.
But Werner knew that that wasn't easy under the best of circumstances. Just as taking tigers alive was far harder than taking them dead, it was difficult to capture someone possessing a loaded submachine gun and the will to use it. Even the HRT shooters, who were trained to bring them in alive in order to toss them in front of a federal district court judge for proper sentencing and caging at Marion, Illinois, hadn't done well in that area. And Rainbow was made up of soldiers for whom the niceties of law were somewhat foreign. The Hague Convention established rules for war that were looser than anything found in the United States Constitution. You couldn't kill prisoners, but you had to capture them alive before they were prisoners, and that was something armies generally didn't emphasize.
"Does our friend Mr. Clark require any more guidance from us?" Werner asked.
"Hey, he's on our side, remember?"
"He's a good guy, yes. Hell, Dan, I met with him while they were setting Rainbow up, and I let him have one of our best troops in Timmy Noonan. And I'll grant you he's done a great job, three of them so far. But he's not one of us, Dan. He doesn't think like a cop, but if he wants better intel, that's what he has to do. Tell him that, will you?"
"I will, Gus," Murray promised. Then they moved on to other things.
"So what are we supposed to do?" Stanley asked. "Shoot the bloody guns out of their hands? That only happens in the cinema, John."
"Weber did exactly that, remember?"
"Yes, and that was against policy, and we damned well can't encourage it," Alistair replied.
"Come on, Al. If we want better intelligence information, we have to capture some alive, don't we?"
"Fine, if possible. Which it rarely will be, John. Bloody rarely."
"I know," Rainbow Six conceded. "But can we at least get the boys to think about it?"
"It's possible, but to make that sort of decision on the fly is difficult at best."
"We need the intel, Al," Clark persisted.
"True, but not at the cost of death or injury to one of our men."
"All things in life are a compromise of some sort," Rainbow Six observed. "Would you like to have some hard intelligence information on these people?"
"Of course, but—"
"But my ass. If we need it, let's figure a way to get it," Clark persisted.
"We're not police constables, John. That is not part of our mission."
"Then we're going to change the mission. If it becomes possible to take a subject alive, then we'll give it a try. You can always shoot him in the head if it's not. The guy Homer took with that gut shot. We could have taken him alive, Al. He wasn't a direct threat to anyone."
"Okay, he deserved it, and he was standing out in the open with a weapon, and our training said kill. And sure enough, Johnston took the shot, and decided to make a statement of his own because he wanted to. But it would have been just as easy to take out his kneecap, in which case we'd have somebody to talk to now. And maybe he would have sung like most of them do. And then maybe we'd know something we'd sure as hell like to know now, wouldn't we?"
"Quite so, John," Stanley conceded.
Arguing with Clark wasn't easy. He'd come to Rainbow with the reputation of a CIA knuckle-dragger, but that's not what he was at all, the Brit reminded himself.
"We just don't know enough, and I don't like not knowing enough about the environment. I think Ding's right. Somebody's setting these bastards loose. If we can figure out a little about that, then maybe we can locate the guy and have the local cops put the bag on him wherever he is. And then maybe we can have a friendly little chat,
and maybe the ultimate result will be fewer incidents to go out and take risks on. The ultimate goal of Rainbow was an odd one, after all, to train for missions that rarely, if ever, came, to be the fire department in a town with no fires.
Very well, John. We should talk with Peter and Domingo about it first of all, I think.
Tomorrow morning, then.
Clark stood from his desk.
How about a beer at the club?
Dmitri Arkadyevich, I haven't seen you in quite some time, the man said.
4 years, Popov confirmed.
They were in London, at a pub 3 blocks from the Russian embassy. He'd taken the train here just on the off chance that one of his former colleagues might show up, and so one had, Ivan Petrovich Kirilenko. Ivan Petrovich had been a rising star, a few years younger than Popov, a skilled field officer who'd made full colonel at the age of 38. Now he was probably...
You are the resident for Station London now?
I am not allowed to say such things, Dmitri.
Kirilenko smiled and nodded even so. He'd come very far and very fast in a downsized agency of the Russian government, and was doubtless still actively pursuing political and other intelligence, or rather, had a goodly staff of people to do it for him. Russia was worried about NATO expansion. The alliance, once so threatening to the Soviet Union, was now advancing eastward toward his country's borders. And some in Moscow worried, as they were paid to worry, that this could be the precursor to an attack on the motherland. Kirilenko knew this was rubbish, as did Popov, but even so he was paid to make sure of it, and the new resident was doing his job as instructed.
So, what are you doing now?
I am not permitted to say.
Which was the obvious reply. It could mean anything. But in the context of their former organization, it meant that Popov was still a player of some sort. What sort, Kirilenko didn't know, though he'd heard that Dmitri Arkadyevich had been riffed from the organization. That had been a surprise to him. Popov still enjoyed an excellent service reputation as a field spook.
I am living between worlds now, Vanya. I work for a commercial business, but I perform other duties as well, he allowed.
The truth was so often a useful tool in the service of lies.
You did not appear here by accident, Kirilenko pointed out.
True.
I hoped to see a colleague here.
The pub was too close to the embassy on Palace Green, Kensington, for serious work, but it was a comfortable place for casual meets, and besides, Kirilenko believed his status as resident to be entirely secret. Showing up in a place like this enhanced that. No real spook, everybody knew, would take the chance.
I need some help with something.
What might that be? The intelligence officer asked over a sip of bitter.
A report on a CIA officer who is probably known to us.
The name?
John Clark.
Why?
He is now, I believe, the leader of a black operation based here in England. I would like to offer the information I have on the man in return for whatever information you might have. I can, perhaps, add a few things to that dossier. I believe my information will be of interest, Popov concluded mildly. In context, it was a large promise.
John Clark, Kirilenko repeated. I will see what I can do for you. You have my number.
Popov slipped a piece of paper on the bar unseen.
Here is my number. No. Do you have a card?
Certainly.
The Russian pocketed the scrap of paper and pulled out his wallet and handed the card over. I.P. Kirilenko, it said. Third Secretary, Russian Embassy, London. 0181-567-9008. With 9009 as the fax number. Popov pocketed the card.
Well, I must get back. Good to see you, Dmitri.
The resident set his glass down and walked out onto the street.
Get the picture? One five man said to the other on the way out the door, about 40 seconds behind their surveillance target.
Well, not good enough for the National Portrait Gallery, but...
The problem with covert cameras was that the lenses were too small to make a really good photo. They were usually good enough for identification purposes, however, and he'd gotten 11 exposures, which, combined with computer enhancement, should be entirely adequate. Kirilenko, they knew, thought his cover to be adequate. He didn't and couldn't know that 5, once called MI5, and now officially called the Security Service, had its own source inside the Russian embassy. The great game was still ongoing in London and elsewhere, New World Order or not. They hadn't caught Kirilenko in a compromising act yet, but he was the resident, after all, and therefore not given to such action. But you tracked such people anyway, because you knew who they were, and sooner or later you got something on them, or from them. Like the chap he'd just had a beer with. Not a regular for this pub. They knew who they were. No name. Just some photos that would be compared with the library of photos at 5's new headquarters building, Thames House, right on the river near Lambeth Bridge. Popoff stepped outside, turned left, and walked past Kensington Palace to catch a cab to the train station. Now if only Kirilenko could get him something of use. He should be able to. He'd offered something juicy in return. Chapter 19. Searching. 3 of the winos died that day, all from internal bleeds in the upper GI. Kilgore went down to check them. 2 had died in the same hour, the 3rd 5 hours later, and the morphine had helped them expire, either unconscious or in a painless, merciful stupor. That left 5 out of the original 10, and none of them would see the end of the week. Shiva was every bit as deadly as they'd hoped, and it would seem just as communicable as Maggie had promised. Finally, the delivery system worked. That was proven by Mary Bannister, subject F4, who'd just moved into the treatment center with the onset of Frank's symptoms. So the Shiva project was fully successful to this point. Everything was nominal to the test parameters and the experimental predictions.
"How bad is the pain?" he asked his doomed patient.
"Cramping. Pretty bad," she replied. "Like flu, plus something else."
"Well, you do have a moderate fever. Any idea where you may have caught it? I mean, there is a new strain of flu out of Hong Kong, and looks like you have it."
"Maybe at work. Before I came here. Can't remember." "I'm going to be okay, right?"
The concern had fought its way through the Valium-impregnated food she got every day.
"I think so."
Kilgore smiled around his surgical mask. "This one can be dangerous, but only to infants and the elderly. And you're not either one of those, are you?"
"I guess not."
She smiled, too, at the reassurance from the physician, which was always comforting.
"Okay, what we're going to do is get an IV started to keep you properly hydrated. And we'll work on the discomfort a little with a little morphine drip, okay?"
"You're the doctor," Subject F4 replied.
"Okay, hold your arm still. I have to make a stick, and it will hurt a little bit." "There," he said, on doing it. "How was that?"
"Not too bad."
"Okay." Kilgore punched in the activation number on the Christmas tree. The morphine drip started instantly. About 10 seconds later, it got into the patient's bloodstream.
Oh, yes," she said,
eyes closed when the initial rush of the drug hit her system.
Kilgore had never experienced it himself, but he imagined it to be almost a sexual feeling, the way the narcotic soothed her entire body. The tension in her musculature all went away at once.
you could see the body relax. Her mouth changed most of all, from tension to the slackness of sleep. It was too bad, really. F4 wasn't exactly beautiful, but she was pretty in her way. And judging from what he'd watched on the control room TV monitor, she was a sexual treat for her partners, even though that had been caused by the tranquilizers. But, good lay or not, she would be dead in 5 to 7 days, despite the best efforts he and his people would render. On the tree was a small drip bottle of interleukin 3A, recently developed by Smith Kline's excellent collection of research scientists for cancer treatment. It had also shown some promise in countering viruses, which was unique in the world of medicine. Somehow it encouraged the body's immune system, though through a mechanism that was not yet understood. It would be the most likely treatment for Shiva victims once the disease became widespread, and he had to confirm that it wouldn't work. That had been the case with the winos, but they also needed to test it in fundamentally healthy patients, male and female, just to make sure. Too bad for her, he thought, since she had a face and a name to go along with her number. It would also be too bad for millions, actually billions, of others. But it would be easier with them. He might see their faces on TV, but TV wasn't real, was it? Just dots on a phosphor screen. The idea was simple enough. A rat was a pig, was a dog, was a boy. Woman, in this case. All had an equal right to life. They'd done extensive testing of Shiva on monkeys, for whom it had proved universally lethal, and he'd watched all those tests, and shared the pain of the subsentient animals who felt pain as real as what F4 felt, though in the case of the monkeys morphine hadn't been possible. And he'd hated that. Hated inflicting pain on innocent creatures with whom he could not talk, and to whom he could not explain things. And though it was justifiable in the big-picture sense, they would be saving millions, billions of animals from the depredations of humans. To see an animal suffer was a lot for him and his colleagues to bear, for they all empathized with all creatures great and small, and more for the small, the innocent, and the helpless, than for the larger two-legged creatures who cared not a whim about them. As F4 probably did not, though they'd never asked. Why confuse the issue, after all? He looked down again. F4 was already stuporous from the narcotic he'd administered. At least she, unlike the experimental monkeys, was not in pain. That was merciful of them, wasn't it? "What black operation is that?" the desk officer asked over the secure phone link. "I have no idea, but he is a serious man, remember? A colonel of the Inostranoi Upravleni. You will recall Division 4, Directorate S. Ah, yes, I know him. He spent much time at Fensterwald and Carlo Vivari. He was rift along with all those people. What is he doing now?" "I do not know, but he offers us information on this clerk in return for some of our data. I recommend that we make the trade, Vasily Borisovich." "Clark is a name known to us. He has met personally with Sergei Nikolaevich," the desk officer told the resident. "He's a senior field officer, principally a paramilitary type, but also an instructor at the CIA Academy in Virginia. He is known to be close to Mary Patricia Foleyeva and her husband. It is also said that he has the ear of the American president. Yes, I think we would be interested in his current activities." The phone they spoke over was the Russian version of the American STU-3, the technology having been stolen about 3 years before by a team working for Directorate T of the first chief directorate. The internal microchips, which had been slavishly copied, scrambled the incoming and outgoing signals with a 128-bit encryption system whose key changed every hour, and changed further with the individual users whose personal codes were part of the insertable plastic keys they used. The STEW system had defied the Russians' best efforts to crack it, even with exact knowledge of the internal workings of the system hardware, and they assumed that the Americans had the same problems. After all, for centuries, Russia had produced the world's best mathematicians, and the best of them hadn't even come up with a theoretical model for cracking the scrambling system. But the Americans had, with the revolutionary application of quantum theory to communication security, a decryption system so complex that only a handful of the Directorate Z people at the National Security Agency actually understood it. But they didn't have to. They had the world's most powerful supercomputers to do the real work. These were located in the basement of the sprawling NSA headquarters building, a dungeon-like area whose roof was held up with naked steel I-beams because it had been excavated for just this purpose. The star machine there was one made by a company gone bankrupt, the superconnector from Thinking Machines, Inc. of Cambridge, Massachusetts. The machine, custom-built for NSA, had sat largely unused for 6 years, because nobody had come up with a way to program it efficiently. But the advent of quantum theory had changed that, too, and the monster machine was now cranking merrily away while its operators wondered who they could find to make the next generation of this complex machine. All manner of signals came into Fort Meade from all over the world, and one such source included GCHQ, Britain's General Communications Headquarters at Cheltenham, NSA's sister service in England. The British knew what phones were whose in the Russian embassy. They hadn't changed the numbers, even with the demise of the USSR. And this one was on the desk of the resident. The sound quality wasn't good enough for a voice print, since the Russian version of the STEW system digitized signals less efficiently than the American version. But once the encryption was defeated, the words were easily recognizable. The decrypted signal was cross-loaded to yet another computer, which translated the Russian conversation to English with a fair degree of reliability. Since the signal was from the London resident to Moscow, it was placed on the top of the electronic pile and cracked, translated, and printed less than an hour after it had been made. That done, it was transmitted to Cheltenham immediately, and at Fort Meade, routed to a signals officer whose job it was to send intercepts to the people interested in the content. In this case, it was routed straight to the Director of Central Intelligence, and, because it evidently discussed the identity of a field spook, to the Deputy Director, Operations, since all the field spooks worked for her. The former was a busier person than the latter, but that didn't matter, since the latter was married to the former. "Ed?" his wife's voice said. "Yeah, honey," Foley replied. "Somebody's trying to ID John Clark over in UK." Ed Foley's eyes went fully open at that news. "Really? Who?" "The station chief in London talked with his desk officer in Moscow, and we intercepted it. The message ought to be in your in-pile, Eddie." "Okay." Foley lifted the pile and leafed through it. "Got it." "Hmm," he said over the phone. "The guy who wants the information, Dmitry Arkadyevich Popov, former colonel in... a terrorism guy, eh? I thought they were all riffed." "Okay, they were, at least he was." "Yeah, Eddie, a terrorism guy is interested in Rainbow Six. Isn't that interesting?"
"I'd say so."
"Get this out to John?" "Bet your sweet little tushy," the D.O. replied at once. "Anything on Popov?"
"I ran the name through the computer."
"Zip," his wife responded.
"I'm starting a new file on the name. Maybe the Brits have something. Want me to call Basil about it?" the D.C.I. asked.
"Let's see what we develop first. Get the facts off to John right away, though."
"It'll go out soon as I get the cover note done," Mary Pat Foley promised.
Hockey game tonight.
The Washington Capitals were closing in on the playoffs, and tonight was a grudge match with the Flyers.
I haven't forgotten. Later, honey bunny.
Bill, John said over the office phone 40 minutes later. You want to come into my office?
On the way, John.
He walked through the door in about 2 minutes.
What's the news?
Check this out, pal.
Clark handed over the 4 pages of transcript.
Bloody hell, the intelligence officer said, as soon as he got to page 2.
Popov Dmitri Arkadyevich.
Doesn't ring a bell.
Oh, I see. They don't know the name at Langley either.
Well, one cannot know them all.
Call Century House about it?
I think we cross-index our files with yours, but it can't hurt. It would appear that Ding was right on this one. How much you want to bet that this is our guy?
Who's your best friend in the security service?
Cyril Holt, Tawney said at once. Deputy Director. I've known Cyril back to rugby. He was a year behind me there. Outstanding chap.
He didn't have to explain to Clark that old-school ties were still a major part of British culture.
Want to get him into this?
Bloody right, John.
Okay, let's make the call. If we decide to go public, I want us to make the decision, not the fucking Russians.
They know your name, then?
More than that. I've met Chairman Golovko. He's the guy who got Ding and me into Tehran last year. I've run a couple of cooperative operations with them, Bill. They know everything down to my dick size.
Tawney didn't react.
He was learning how Americans talked, and it was often very entertaining.
You know, John, you ought not to get too excited about this information.
Bill, you've been in the field as much as I have, maybe a little more. If this doesn't make your nose twitch, get something to clean your sinuses out, will you?
Clark paused for a second.
We got somebody who knows me by name, and is hinting that he can tell the Russians what I'm doing now.
He's got to know, man. He picked the London resident to tell, not the one in Caracas. A terrorism guy, maybe a guy who knows names and numbers. And we've had 3 incidents since we got here. And we've agreed that's a lot for so short a time. And now this guy comes up on the scope, asking about me.
Bill, I think it's time to get a little excited, okay?
Quite so, John.
I'll get Cyril on the phone.
Tawney left the room.
Fuck, John breathed, when the door closed.
That was the problem with black operations. Sooner or later, some bastard flipped the light switch. And it was generally somebody you didn't even want in the room. How the hell has this one leaked?
His face darkened as he looked down at his desk, acquiring an expression that those who knew it considered very dangerous indeed.
Shit, Director Murray said at his desk in FBI headquarters.
Yeah, Dan, that about covers it, Ed Foley agreed from his 7th-floor office in Langley.
How the hell did this leak?
Beats the hell out of me, man. You have anything on this Popoff that I don't know about?
I can check with intelligence and terrorism divisions, but we cross-deck everything to you.
What about the Brits?
If I know John, he's already on the phone to 5 and 6. His intel guy is Bill Tawney, and Bill's top drawer in any outfit.
Know him?
Rings a vague bell, but I can't put a face on it.
What's Basil think of him?
Says he's one of his best analysts, and was a primo field spook until a few years ago.
He's got a good nose, the DCI told Murray.
How big a threat is this?
Can't tell yet. The Russians know John pretty well from Tokyo and Tehran. Golovko knows him personally. Called me about the Tehran job to compliment him on the job he and Chavez pulled off. I gather they hit it off, but this is business, not personal, you know.
I hear you, Don Corleone.
Okay, what do you want me to do?
Well, there's a leak somewhere. I haven't got a clue yet where it might be. The only talk I've heard about Rainbow has been people with code word clearance.
They're supposed to know about keeping their mouths shut.
Right, Murray snorted. The only people able to leak stuff like this were the people you trusted. People who'd passed a serious background check done by special agents of the FBI. Only a trusted and checked-out person could really betray his country, and unfortunately the FBI hadn't yet learned to look inside a person's brain and heart. And what if it had been an inadvertent leak? You could interview the person who'd done it, and even he or she couldn't reply that it had happened. Security and counter-espionage were two of the hardest tasks in the known universe. Thank God, he thought, for the crippies at NSA. As always, the most trusted and productive of his country's intelligence services.
Bill, we have a two-man team on Kirilenko almost continuously. They just photographed him having a pint with a chap at his usual pub last night, Cyril Holt told his six colleague.
That may well be our man, Tawny said.
Quite possible. I need to see your intercepts. Want me to drive out?
Yes, as quickly as you can.
Fine, give me 2 hours, old man. I still have a few things on my desk to attend to.
Excellent.
The good news was that they knew this phone was secure in two different ways. The STU-4 encryption system could be beaten, but only by technology that only the Americans had, or so they thought. Better still, the phone lines used were computer-generated. One advantage to the fact that the British telephone system was essentially owned by the government was that the computers controlling the switching systems could randomize the routings and deny anyone the chance to tap into a call, unless there was a hardwire connection at the point of origin or reception. For that bit of security, they relied on technicians who checked the lines on a monthly basis. Unless one of them was working for someone else as well, Tawny reminded himself. You couldn't prevent everything, and while maintaining telephone silence could deny information to a potential enemy, it also had the effect of stopping the transfer of information within the government, thus causing that institution to grind to an immediate smoking halt.
Go ahead, say it, Clark told Chavez.
Easy, Mr. C. Not like I predicted the outcome of the next World Series. It was pretty obvious stuff.
Maybe so, Domingo, but you still said it first.
Chavez nodded. Problem is, what the hell do we do about it? John, if he knows your name, he either already knows or can easily find out your location. And that means us. Hell, all he needs is a pal in the phone company, and he starts staking us out. Probably has a photo of you or a description. Then he gets a tag number and starts following you around.
We should be so lucky.
I know about counter-surveillance, and I have a shoe phone everywhere I go. I'd love for somebody to try that on me. I'd have you and some of your boys come out to the country, do a pick-and-roll, bag the fucker, and then we could have a friendly little chat with him.
That generated a thin smile. John Clark knew how to extract information from people, though his techniques for doing so didn't exactly fit guidelines given to the average police departments.
I suppose, John. But for now there's not a damn thing we can do except keep our eyes open and wait for someone else to generate some information for us.
I've never been a target like this before. I don't like it.
I hear you, man, but we live in an imperfect world.
What's Bill Tawny say?
He has a five guy coming out later today.
Well, they're the pros from Dover on this. Let them do their thing, Ding advised.
He knew it was good advice, indeed the only possible advice, and knew that John knew that, and he also knew that John would hate it. His boss liked doing things himself, not waiting for others to do things for him. If Mr. C had a weakness, that was it. He could be patient while working, but not while waiting for things to happen beyond his purview. Well, nobody was perfect.
Yeah, I know, was the reply. How are your troops?
Riding the crest of the wave, man.
right in the curl and looking down the pipeline. I have never seen morale this good, John. The World Park job just lit everybody up. I think we can conquer the whole world if the bad guys line up properly.
The Eagle looks pretty good in the club, doesn't it?
Bet your sweet ass, Mr. C. Ain't no nightmares from this one.
Well, except for the little girl. That wasn't fun to watch. Even if she was dying anyway, you know. But we got the bastards, and Mr. Carlos is still in his cage. I don't figure anybody else is going to try to spring his sorry ass.
And he knows it, the French tell me.
Chavez stood.
Good. I gotta get back. Keep me in the loop on this, okay?
Sure will, Domingo, Rainbow Six promised.
So, what sort of work do you do?
The plumber asked.
I sell plumbing supplies, Popoff said. Wrenches and so forth. Wholesale to distributors and retailers.
Indeed. Anything useful?
Rigid pipe wrenches. The American brand. They're the best in the world, and they have a lifetime guarantee. If one breaks, we replace it free, even 20 years from now. Various other things as well, but rigid wrenches are my best product.
Really?
I've heard about them, but I've never used them. The adjustment mechanism is a little steadier than the English Stilson spanner. Other than that, the only real advantage is the replacement policy. You know, I've been selling these things for, what, 14 years, I think? I've had one break from all the thousands I've sold.
Hmph.
I broke a wrench last year, the plumber said. Anything unusual about work on the base?
Not really.
Plumbing is plumbing. Some of the things I work on are rather old, the water coolers, for example. Getting parts for the bloody things can be troublesome, and they can't make the decision to get new ones. Bloody government bureaucrats. They must spend thousands a week for bullets for their bloody machine guns, but purchase some new water coolers that people will use every day? Not bloody likely.
The man had a good laugh and sipped at his lager.
What sort of people are they?
The SAS team? Good blokes. Very polite chaps. They make no trouble for me and my mates at all.
What about the Americans? Popoff asked. I've never really known any, but you hear stories about how they do things their own way, and
not in my experience.
Well, I mean only lately have we had any at the base. But the two or three I've worked for are just like our chaps. And remember I told you, they tried to tip us.
Bloody Yanks.
But friendly chaps. Most of them have kids, and the children are lovely. Learning to play proper football now, some of them.
So, what are you doing around here?
Meeting with the local ironmongers, trying to get them to carry my brands of tools. And also the local distributor.
Lee and Dopkin?
The plumber shook his head. Both are old buggers. They won't change very much. You'll do better with the little shops than with them, I'm afraid.
Well, how about your shop? Can I sell you some of my tools?
I don't have much of a budget. But, well, I'll look at your wrenches.
When can I come in?
Security mate is rather tight here. I doubt they'll allow me to drive you onto the base. But, well, I could bring you in with me. Say, tomorrow afternoon?
I'd like that.
When?
Tomorrow afternoon? I could pick you up here.
Yes, Popoff said. I'd like that.
Excellent. We can have a plowman's lunch here, and then I'll take you in myself.
I'll be here at noon, Popoff promised, with my tools.
Cyril Holt was over 50, and had the tired look of a senior British civil servant. Well-dressed in a finely tailored suit and an expensive tie, clothing over there, Clark knew, was excellent, but not exactly cheap. He shook hands all around and took his seat in John's office.
"So," Holt said, "I gather we have a problem here."
"You've read The Intercept?"
"Yes,"
Holt nodded.
"Good work by your NSA chaps."
He didn't have to add that it was good work by his chaps as well, identifying the line used by the resident.
"Tell me about Kirilenko," Clark said.
competent chap. He has a staff of 11 field officers and perhaps a few other off-the-books helpers to do pickups and such. Those are all legals with diplomatic cover.